and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, China experts James and Deborah Fallows. In the afternoon of November 12th, Deborah Fallows, author of Dreaming in Chinese, spoke at the UAA bookstore. You can find a link to a podcast of the bookstore event on alaskapublic.org. Today on Addressing Alaskans, we present the evening presentation at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, where Deborah provided the opening remarks, followed by her husband, national correspondent for The Atlantic and National Book Award winner, James Fallows. His talk, entitled Postcards from Tomorrow Square, was part of the Bartlett Lecture Series, recorded at UAA on November 12.
Good evening. James Fallows is based in Washington as a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has worked for the magazine for nearly 30 years, and in that time has also lived in Seattle, Berkeley, Austin, Tokyo, Kuala Lumpur, Shanghai, and Beijing. He's raised in Redlands, California, received his undergraduate in American history and literature from Harvard, and received a graduate degree in economics from Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. In addition to working for The Atlantic, he has spent 2 years as chief White House speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, has spent two years as the editor of U.S. News and World Report, and 6 months as a program designer at Microsoft. He is an instrument-rated private pilot and is also now the chair in U.S. Media and the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney in Australia. Fallows has been a finalist for the National Magazine Award 5 times and has won once. He has also won the American Book Award for Nonfiction and a New York Emmy Award for the documentary series Doing Business in China. He was the founding chairman of the New America Foundation. His 2 most recent books, Blind in Baghdad and Postcards from Tomorrow Square, are based on his writings from The Atlantic. His latest book, China Airborne, was published in early May. He is married to Deborah Fallows. She is the author of Dreaming in China, has lived in Shanghai and Beijing, and traveled throughout China for 3 years with her husband. She is a Harvard graduate and has a PhD in linguistics. She most recently worked in research and polling for the Pew Institute project and in data architecture for Oxygen magazine. When in the U.S., her and her husband live in Washington, D.C., and they also have 2 sons. Please welcome James and Deborah Fallows.
Warm-up act for Jim tonight. You can think of me as just a tiny appetizer, and he's going to be the main course. So I just am going to do 2 things and talk for just a couple minutes. The first is to give you just a little bit of background of how we got to China, and the second is to just give you a little view into how I spent my time in China and what I learned there, which is very different from the way how Jim spent his time in China. So Jim has been working as a journalist for 30 or 40 years now, and it's been the pattern in our life that we've spent about half of our time in Washington, D.C., and the other half in these exotic places around the world like Malaysia and Japan and Seattle and Berkeley and Europe and Africa. And about 6, 7, or 8 years ago, we decided that it was time to get out of town again in Washington, D.C., and could think of no place that would be more interesting as a place to spend some time and try to learn about in China. So we prepared as much as we could to head out there for 3 years and just to see what we would find and see what we could report on and see what we'd learn about the country that we knew would be so important not only in the rest of our, in our lifetime, I hate to say the rest of our lifetime, it kind of makes me feel too old, and certainly in our children's lifetime and our grandchildren. So we did that, and part of my role in all these escapades is to learn as much of the language as I can. My background is in languages and linguistics, and as we've gone around the world. I've tried to, both for because it was important and because I was interested in it, to learn about the language. So when we went headed for China, it was the same thing. I studied at Georgetown University for about a year in taking some Mandarin classes. Interesting thing that happened after that was that I quickly discovered that Chinese was nothing like any other language I had ever studied. It was very difficult, but for a lot of different reasons, tones for one and the sound system for another. But it also was unusual in many aspects. There were a lot of the things of the grammar that I just hadn't run into in any other language before. Certainly the sound system was extremely different. I found it very hard to get traction at all, and it just took me a real lot of time to get going. But I did study, and I spent a lot of time in China studying the language. And as a linguist, what I tried to do, just because I needed a little sense of control over our crazy life there in China, was to look into the language. And whenever I found something about the language that seemed unusual or curious or particularly difficult, I would try as a linguist to look at that, grab that little bit of the language, and find some linguistic explanation for it. And what I found along the way was not only linguistic explanations, but that by some kind of miracle, what I discovered about the language was also teaching me things about the culture of China that I had no idea would relate to each other. So I ended up learning a lot about relationships, or about protocol and behavior, or about the sense of romance or the sense of humor that Chinese have. And so what I want to do tonight is just give you one example of those. And it's actually the basis of what I ended up writing about in Dreaming in Chinese, is a lot of these linguistic curiosities of the language and what they taught me, not only about language, but about the Chinese culture and the Chinese people. So the one thing I'd like to talk about tonight is the word for love, which in Chinese is pronounced ai. And of course, the sense of love is, the word love is fraught in any language, but it really got my interest very early on. In the mid-80s, we went to China for the first time. And at that point, we had our two little blonde, blue-eyed sons with us. They were about 5 and 8 at that point. And we were spending some time in Guilin in the south of China and had these two little boys with us. And I was talking to a Chinese woman who was on the same tour with us. It was actually the World Esperanto Congress, but that's another complete story. And she was looking at me and looking at our little sons, two little guys, looking back at me and said, "Well, which of them do you love more?" And I was taken aback, you know, so I can't answer that. Of course, I love them both the same, and thinking, what kind of question is that? Why would someone ask me that? And so she looked at me again, and she looked at the boys and kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit and said, "But really, which one do you love more?" And it always stuck with me. It stuck with me because it's such a peculiar kind of question to ask, and I just put it in the back of my mind to retrieve it later at some point. So fast forward about 20 or 25 years later, when we ended up in China again, just in 2006, and another curious thing happened with this word love. By the time we were in China for a year or so, we'd had the opportunity to meet a lot of Chinese Western couples. And let's just say that the man is Western and the woman is Chinese. Inevitably, as we got to know them a little bit better, we would have this same conversation that would come up, and it went something like this. The Western man would start complaining, "My Chinese wife, she'll never say I love you. No matter if it's in English or Chinese, she just can't bring herself to say I love you. Wo ai ni." And then the Chinese woman would say, "Oh, my husband, he's always saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's so gratuitous. It's so meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. Keeps insisting on saying I love you." So I thought, you know, there it is again, that funny word. And what could possibly be going on? Then another thing happened. In Beijing, I met a woman who was in her mid-30s, a Chinese woman. We were spending some time together. And very quickly, one of the first things that she asked me was, you've been married a long time. You must love your husband very much. I thought, well, this is funny. I mean, we Chinese women do have a way of getting to know you pretty quickly, but as one of the first questions that comes out, you must love him very much, thought, well, yes, but in response, you know, I just said to her, well, I'm sure you must love your husband very much too. And she said, I love him for now. Which, again, gave me some pause, and I'm thinking, okay, we've got something going on here with this word love that I clearly don't understand. And trying to give her the benefit of the doubt, I'm thinking, you know, Chinese doesn't have any tenses. You just kind of have to put things in context with today or tomorrow or yesterday or whatever else it is. So I thought maybe she's just getting confused because of tenses. She really means in some existential way, I love him forever, or I love him, or I am loving him. Or maybe she's just being a very practical-minded young Chinese woman, and for now is kind of a good thing. So I looked into a little bit of history about the word love and marriage and found some curious kinds of things. When first in the Confucian era, say 100 years ago or so, the sense of love was all about harmony and obedience and really not very much about romance. And then moving on to the Mao era, it was much more about a sense of practicality. Marriage, if it was politically correct, it was good for the state, that was a good thing. And now in China, you see, you know, I heard from these young women, it was partly about practicality, they wanted to make a good marriage, but definitely there was a lot more romance going on. So all of this seemed to be a little bit in flux, and I had it in my mind when we were out on the streets of Beijing, as I was every single day. And I just want to read you a couple paragraphs of having that background in mind, what I saw with respect to the idea of love. The Cherry Blossom Spring Flower Festival this year happened to coincide with the first gloriously warm, clear weekend days of the season. All of Beijing was out of doors after the dark and dreary winter. On Sunday at Yuyuantan Park, on the west side of the city, the boys bought their girls sprigs of bright pink and white plastic cherry blossoms, which the girls wound into wreaths and wore in their hair. The lake was crowded with pedal boats, and farmers sold baby chicks and bunnies from cardboard boxes. Everyone was paired off, or so it seemed. Young couples filled the subway and the parks that day, all locked in embrace. They held hands, they hugged, they kissed, they spooned, all mindless or careless of their public display. I would say that this was the youth of the Marry for Love generation. But on that same day, had we been in Shanghai People's Park instead, we would have no doubt seen again the serious matchmaking meetings that we observed every weekend when we lived in Shanghai. Parents in their 50s worried over their unmarried offspring in their late 20s. They'd gather in the northwest corner of the park with their homemade signs describing their children. This son was born in the year of the monkey. He was 1.8 meters tall. He had a job in a private company, and he was type A blood. That daughter was a graduate of East China Normal University. She was 1.6 meters tall, type A blood, and of Han ethnic origin. The parents would circle around cautiously, reading each other's posters, huddling with their spouses, and perhaps sidling up to another couple to strike up a conversation and see where things might go from there. The grown children were never in evidence. Who knows? They may have been locked in embrace in the number 2 subway line at that very moment. These were adults of another era, and they were still trying to arrange marriages for their very modern youth. So what this really taught me was that this whole sense of love and this whole sense of marriage was really a metaphor for a lot that was going on in China at the time. A lot of change, a lot of churn, a lot of mismatches from one generation to another, and a lot of reflection in just that single word, love. So that's just kind of a brief example of how my life went in China, was dealing with this language and trying to put it together with what I saw in the streets of Shanghai or Beijing and make some sense of it for our life in China. So with that, I would like to give you Jim, temporarily.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have a list of thanks to people here, but of course, first I have to thank my wonderful wife, Deb, to whom I've been married for many years, and it only becomes more worthwhile and more enjoyable, and we're really glad to be here together again, so thanks for having us. Thanks to President Alejandra for her nice welcome to us. Thanks to the Student Affairs Operation here, the Bartlett Series, which is a tremendous honor to be part of, the World Affairs Council and Lisa, Public Broadcasting Operation and Steve. We did have lunch 30 years ago in the Captain Cook Hotel, and I believe there was an earthquake while we were having lunch. I'm sure it's just an average day here, but it was interesting for us, and so I remembered that. Thanks to the Confucius Institute, too, whose teachers and director, Annie, we've been seeing, and we really are impressed by what you've all been doing. So thanks to you all for coming out this evening. Here is the way that I thought that I would try to structure my comments for the next while about China and America and relations between China and America, and then raise some questions or offer some possibilities for you all before Deb and I come back here and she can tell me what I got wrong. This is an area she's well experienced in over the years. We can have a discussion there and answer any of your questions. And the way I thought I would do this was to set up a comparison between China and America this way. As you know, this month, the two leading powers in the world, by most measures, are choosing new presidents. The United States for the next 4 years, China probably for the next 10 years. It'll be officially in two blocks of 5 years. We know what happened 6 days ago in the United States. We know that the process of choosing a president here is transparent to a fault. We know way more than we'd like to about many of the candidates, the way they did their business. The process is going on right now in China. We know hardly anything about. We know who the next leader is probably going to be. We don't know whether he's going to have six other members with him on the Paramount Ruling Committee or eight other members or who they'll be or exactly what horses are being traded to make these deals or who will be in charge of the military or a lot of other questions. It is interesting to contrast these political systems and the way these two countries think about the prospects for the next presidential election as they happen to do it at the same time. Here's a pop quiz. Who remembers the last time China and the United States chose a president right at the same moment? And you can figure it out if you think China has a 5-year cycle, we have a 4-year cycle. The answer is 20 years ago. In 1992, when Bill Clinton, as you will recall, now known as Barack Obama's best friend, he was then the new American president, came in, and Jiang Zemin, who is now sort of the eminence grise of Chinese politics, came in as the new president of China. So it's an unusual thing that's happening now. And I thought the way to observe this would be to think if we were doing either a historical study 50 or 100 years from now, of China and the United States at this moment in their shared transitions. Or if any of you, you know there's an opening for a new CIA director, if any of you were applying for a CIA director's job, if you wanted to do sort of a country assessment of both China and the United States as they look forward to a next presidential regime, that's the kind of comparative matchup I'd like to do. What are the strengths and the problems of China and the United States right now? How do they affect their relationships with each other? And from an American point of view, if you accept the analysis I'm giving, what does that make you think we should do as private individuals, as companies, as a collectivity, et cetera? So that is the plan. I'm going to talk first about China from this sort of cold-eyed assessment point of view, then about America, and then about them together, and then some of the payoff of what we should do. Now I have the audience poll period part of the presentation. How many people here actually are Chinese? You know, born in China, spent some time. Deb, are you raising your hand? Yeah. Deb kind of is Chinese. I think we decided when she was there, she actually is a Chinese woman in her spirit. So there are a few Chinese people here. How many people have been to China at all? Probably a large number. How many have been there for more than, say, a month? a significant number, and how many have been to places outside the East Coast, that is, you know, to one of the interior provinces. So this is a well experienced audience. This is both good and bad from my point of view. it's good in that I can allude to some things offhandedly. It's bad in that you will know where I'm making things up, but that will save that for the question period. If we were doing this historical assessment of China in the year 2012, that is, in the early 60 years of its history as a communist country, 30 years of its modern history as a country following Deng Xiaoping that decided it would discard rigid communist ideology and decide what would work and how it could re-enter the world of modern economic competition. We'd have to start with an assessment that this China had been a tremendous success in two ways, and two and a half, I'll even say. The first way in which it has been a tremendous success is economic transformation of human conditions on a scale mankind and humankind has never seen before. And as you know, and it's worth emphasizing, in the last 30 years, hundreds of millions of people have gone from a life of real rural subsistence, no electricity, no clean water life, to an urban working class life or urban shopkeeper life. And this is a process that took a century plus in Europe, a century or so in the United States. In 30 years, it's happened in China. And there are side effects of this modernization, which we all know, and which I'll mention, environmental ones especially. But in terms of human welfare, if you've been to Chinese farms, again, how many people have been to Chinese farms? I bet a lot of you have been on Chinese farms. You know that's a fate that is admirable in certain ways, but is really, really tough. You know, if you're cold and you're diseased and all the rest. So that is one huge achievement of the system that nobody can take away from them. A second related success is the political legitimacy this achievement has made for the communist government so far. And so far, you'll see why I emphasize those words. Many Americans, with our skepticism of authoritarian government and our awareness of all the abuses in China's system over the last 60 years, have wondered why people would accept it. I think the answer is for almost every Chinese family, if they look back 5 years, they're better off. If they look back 20 years, they're much, much better off. And they look back 30 years, it's just unrecognizable, the circumstances for most families in that period. And so many people will say a system that can do this for us deserves the benefit of the doubt. It deserves our sense that it knows what it's doing overall. And so there is the kind of legitimacy that goes with that, despite all the complaints that come up about things that are going wrong in China. There's an additional one-half achievement, when I was mentioning successes of the Chinese approach, that any assessor right now would have to acknowledge, which is a sense of historical validation or pride and respect and achievement for China as an entity. All of you who've spent time in China have, like me, heard hundreds of times the phrase the 100 years of humiliation or the century of humiliation, China's time as an object of Western colonialism, Western drug peddling, Western invasion, Japanese invasion, and all the rest, the sense that one of the world's great powers was weak and was not able to stand up for itself. The reason that Deb and I, as residents of Beijing at the time, wanted the Olympics to be seen as a big success for China, as I think they overall were, was just because it is good from the Chinese perspective that they have a sense that they are going someplace, that the chip on the shoulder that comes from being looked down on by the West. You know, it's one more step of achievement. And I think all these things are part of why Chinese people looking back over the last 30 years saying, this has basically worked. Many Americans are startled to go to China and see Chairman Mao's picture on all the money and his portraits all over the place. And if you ask many Chinese people, well, what about the downside? You know, what about the Cultural Revolution? What about the Great Leap Forward? They probably don't know about the mass starvation of the Great Leap Forward years, except out in the villages. But even so, the answer standardly is Mao was 70% right. And the 70% right is that he sort of brought China ahead as a nation, as a power. He made it independent. So on the one side of our ledger, we need to place all the things that have worked. And I think that the historian looking back will also say that this side of the ledger was, if anything, overappreciated in much of the outside world. Who here saw the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics? You know, we were in Beijing then, and the reaction we got from most of our American friends was, after seeing that ceremony, it was, God save us, we're doomed. You know, because they've had the image of hundreds of millions of Chinese people working in perfect precision, which, as those of you who've been there know, that's not how it always is all the time. And the Olympics were just, it was a miracle they came off as well as they did, and a good miracle. So there is a sense in the outside world of China being unstoppable, China being all-powerful. People in Australia, 75% of them, now believe that China's economy is the biggest in the world, which it isn't. It's depending on your measure, it's about half the size of the U.S. economy, or slightly more or less. So these are all the successes which maybe are overappreciated. Now suppose we were doing the other side of the ledger, saying if you were the new incoming president of China, what would you be worried about? What would you think is really a challenge for the next 5 years and the 5 years beyond that? I think you would start to get a little bit worried as you looked down the list of things that your administration is going to have to deal with. First, you would have the simplest problem, short-term economics. In the last 4 or 5 years, short-term economic cycles have been a problem every place, a worry every place. They are in China, too. I won't get into details about that, but there are reasons to think that unemployment might be an issue again there, land bubbles, etc. So that's, in a way, the easiest one, the short-term economics. The next problem, which is a more genuine intellectual challenge, is the longer-term economics. And let me use a prop here. I hold in my hand, because I'm reading my notes from it, an iPad. Many of you may have a device like this in your own household. About 2 weeks ago, I was seeing the place in China where all of these things are made. You know, they're all made in a Foxconn factory, and I was seeing this. You know that all of your electronic goods are made in China, or virtually all of them. What many of the Chinese leadership understand, that many people in America don't, is that the $500 I paid for this iPad, only about $50 stayed in China. The rest goes to Apple and to the retailers and to the advertisers and the screen makers and all the rest. And there is a sense, there's a question among the Chinese leadership about whether the model of the last 30 years, which is giving peasants jobs by building roads and building new cities and building airports and employing them in low-wage factories, whether that model is topping out and whether 30 years from now China will be anything other than a bigger version of that, a bigger version of a low-wage workhouse for the world. What this involves is being able to not just assemble things for Apple, but have their own Apples. Not just have a sort of competitor to Google, but their own Googles. Having their own Boeings, their own pharmaceutical companies, and all the rest. The point of my recent book, China Airborne, is to examine all the different factors that are going to make it challenging for China to take this next step and to ask, can this country become a genuinely rich country as opposed to a less poor country, which is what it has been in the last while? That would be your next worry if you were a Chinese leader. But then we get to the real one. The real one is the environment, which I'll do another poll. I'm going to assert that the environment is the worst problem for China and its sort of greatest impact on the rest of the world. How many and the choices will be you agree with that or you have something else you think is their biggest problem. So you agree the environment is their worst problem. Those of you who think that there's something else that is a worse problem for China. Interesting. And so in the question period, I'll ask you to volunteer what you think that is. The reason I think the environment is the biggest challenge for China is there are symptoms internally in China. For example, cancer epidemics, birth defect epidemics, all sorts of things which come from poisoned food supplies and poisoned air and poisoned groundwater and all the rest. There is tremendous public this issue in China. Lots of protests around the country from farmers whose land is no longer usable, fishermen who have those problems, parents whose children are having challenges. The government, interestingly and admirably, has tried to place itself on the right side of this issue, saying that, yes, we're going to allow press reports on environmental issues. We're going to work hard to cope with it. So I think, actually, the Chinese government is trying as hard as it can to move things ahead in this front, but there's a long way to go. One of my most vivid memories here, which I described in my previous book, was talking with the man who was in charge of cleaning up Beijing's air for the Olympic Games, which was a challenging job and succeeded. And he'd set himself a deadline. He said that he wanted in his own lifetime to see this or that environmental achievement. And he was accelerating the timetable for himself because he was a three-pack-a-day smoker. So he thought that he was really going to bring on this deadline of having things be improved. But there's the environmental challenges there are important for China. The water situation is really significant. They also are the main influence of China in the external world now. You know, in Alaska with some of the emissions, the global climate issues and all the rest. So that, I am sure, is very much in the consciousness of the leaders in Beijing. I'll list three or four other things just to give you an idea of why I think historians 50 years from now and our analysts right now would say this is not just the kind of automatic juggernaut that many Westerners assume, but a genuine question about how China will be able to go forward. The next one on this list would be international soft power. And here I'll say something very positive and complimentary about the Confucius Institute that's working here in the university and that I think is doing a lot of beneficial things around the world. I'm in favor of everybody learning more languages. I think Americans should be exposed to Chinese to become comfortable with it, and it's a great thing for the Confucius Institute to do. Most of the things the Chinese government tries to do in terms of soft power and buying goodwill for China other than just in commercial ways end up backfiring because of the sort of hyper-cautious, hyper-paranoid nature of the Chinese government. I'll give you this one illustration. Also during the Olympic Games, the foreign ministry made a point of having an authorized protest zone for people who wanted to protest whatever they chose during the Olympic Games, a sign of China's openness to this kind of free discussion as a successful power. As it happened, no protests were actually authorized because people who applied were arrested. You know, the security ministry said this was a convenient way to see people who were dissenting. And it's not that this was a clever ploy. The foreign ministry genuinely wanted to show this side of China's face to the world, and the security state genuinely thought, well, this is a problem we have to control. And in many other ways, you see this tension between the parts of the Chinese leadership and population and government that have the idea of moving ahead and having China really mature as a state to match the way it has as an economy and as a society. And how that struggle plays itself out, I think, is really, really important. Here's a domestic example. You all recall in the time after the 9/11 attacks in the United States, the battles over almost everything between the security interests and business interests or whatever else. It affects airline travel. It affects everything. It affected immigration. Think of the way we closed ourselves off to immigration for several years because of 9/11 overreaction, in my view. That tension in America for a couple of years and ongoing now, I think, is a small sample of the tension every day for the Chinese leadership. The security interests on one side, the modernization interests on another side. A lot of my recent book, China Airborne, is about this too. For example, Chinese airlines, they often burn much more fuel per mile of travel than Western ones do, because the military makes them fly at very low altitudes, which is very inefficient for airliners, but it's part of the military control of airspace. So this is one more challenge for China. There's I'll sort of just to get to the point here, that there most of the other challenges for the Chinese leadership involve what I will say is the deliberately provocative phrase going up of whether the leadership in China can have the confidence and toleration that comes with a mature governing system rather than one that fears dissent of all kinds. The censorship of the internet is probably the main indicator here, the way we can tell how the government is relaxing. China has tremendous ambitions to have the world's leading university system, but ask yourselves if you had the chance as a world-leading professor to go to Paris or to Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Cambridge, England, or to Anchorage, or someplace in China, and you knew the internet didn't work very well in China. That probably would be one of many things making it difficult for you. There is, a few weeks ago, I had a chance to moderate a debate that in a way distills the debate going on in China. It was between a man named Minxin Pei, PEI, who is a professor at Claremont McKenna College, and a man named Eric Li, L-I, essentially arguing, could the Chinese system take the next step? And one made the case that it was nearing its contradictions, the other that it had managed so many transitions in the last 30 years, it would manage them again. That is the debate that, as a strategic analyst of China, you'd be asking about. I'll add only one more point on the Chinese side of the equation before coming to the United States. That is, America has a horse in this race. There's a side that we would like to win. The side we should like to win is that of China continuing to succeed, continuing to rise, continuing to empower its people, because the only thing that will be more troublesome for the world than a successful China is a failed one, for reasons I will get to later on. So it will be better for us if things go well there than if they go poorly.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with National Correspondent for The Atlantic, James Fallows. As part of the Bartlett Lecture Series at UAA, his talk entitled Postcards from Tomorrow Square was recorded in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on November 12th.
That is my long section on the China analyst side of the balance, of what you'd think if you were looking at them now, the strengths of these decades of success, the challenges. Now, what if you looked at the American side? What would you say about this civilization, this economy, this political system, and whether it can make it? I'm going to divert for 2 minutes to talk politics. I once worked in politics. I was on the Democratic side. I worked for Jimmy Carter as a speechwriter, as a much younger man, and Jimmy Carter, for young people in the audience, former president of the United States. Both younger and older members of the audience will know that he had many virtues, but giving good speeches was not one of them. So being his speechwriter was a character-building exercise, and I built my character for a couple of years, and then I passed the baton to a man named Rick Hertzberg, who's now a writer for the New Yorker. And so I was watching very carefully the contest over the last year, the results of the last week or so, and I'll be happy to give you more details and questions. Let me just make a point or two here, something about politics and something about policy. On the politics, I think we may have seen the tail end of a 40-year movement in American politics. And that 40 years was launched by Richard Nixon with his so-called Southern Strategy in the late 1960s. And the idea was the white South had been the bedrock of the Democratic Party. They were being driven away by from the Democratic Party by the civil rights legislation of the mid-60s. Richard Nixon made them the bedrock of the Republican Party, and that's been their strength ever since then. When that approach has been running into some problems, of course, is when the white South and white people are no longer such a strong preponderance of the electorate. And over the years, the Democrats have been doing much better, of course, with African Americans and with Latinos and with Asians and with women and with young people and with highly educated people and with gays and lesbians. And you have something like the polar bear on the shrinking iceberg for the Republican Party that I think many of its leaders are reflecting upon right now. So I can say more about the election if you want, but I think that's the way we might look at it historically. The election of 1968 was the beginning of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. The election of 2012 may mark the end of that 40-plus year period where something else has to be done for the Republicans. The other point I'll make about is that I think that it matters. It matters tremendously it is more significant for Barack Obama that he was reelected than that he was elected the first time. You recognize the logical limit in what I'm saying. He can't have been reelected unless he were elected the first time, but I think the fact that he's going to have a second term means much more than a doubling of his influence. It's more like a 4 or 5 scale influence of what he'll be likely to do for these reasons that I'll just tick off quickly. One is, I did a long article earlier this year in The Atlantic trying to assess how Obama had done, and I said the reason I want to do it before the election occurs is that as of the day after the election, we'll never be able to view his first term clearly again, because it just is inevitable. If a president is reelected, everything about his first term seems part of a seamless plan where any of the problems are mere bumps in the road. If he's defeated, even the good things he did are sort of overlooked, as for Carter. Panama Canal Treaty, Middle East, who cares? He was a loser. So there was that. So the fact that there is the first fact that the Obama narrative will now be one of success rather than of failure. There's a second fact, which is most people think, and I would argue, the next 4 years will probably be an economic time up rather than a time down we've been through the past few years. Whichever administration presides over the next 4 years, will we be able to base its narrative? You know, our plan of public investment has brought on these good times. Or if Romney had won, our plan of tax cuts had brought on these good times. So there is that effect that it is likely to have. The health care law is likely now to go into effect as opposed to being overturned. I contend that 10 years from now, people will take provisions of this law as much for granted as they do Medicare now, even though Medicare was even more controversial when it was passed than the Obama bill was. Finally, Supreme Court appointments. There will be probably certainly one, probably two, perhaps three in the next 4 years. That is a way we've seen the lever they exert over national policy. So to talk about politics, I'll leave the politics to that. It's a significant moment for the Republicans, and it's also a significant moment for Obama, but in different ways. But let's return now to our strategic assessment of the United States. First, I'm going to skip past the successes because our American narrative in these recent years has been dominated by our failures and problems. Polls showing America going the right direction or the wrong way are dominated by wrong way recently. You recall the Tea Party uprising of the last 2 or 3 years, driven by the sense that America is having shrinking horizons. In most parts of the world, people think the United States is on the way down and China and others are on the way up. I contend that actually our prospects are much better than that, with one important exception. Now, of course, we have problems of every sort. I think the worst one is economic polarization in our country, which we've experienced before in the 1890s, and many, many aspects of that Gilded Age we're experiencing now. And if I were making you read American history books, I would direct you towards those of the 1890s. But having spent a lot of my life outside the United States looking in, I would argue there are several advantages we have that nobody else really is going to be able to match for a very long time. One of them that's illustrated by a number of people in this room, and that Alaska understands and America understands too, is our ability to absorb and withstand immigration. I say absorb and withstand because this is really a difficult process wherever it happens. Japan simply can't absorb immigrants. It's too shocking. The other countries that are flexible, as the U.S. is, are small in population, Canada, Australia, et cetera. Bigger countries have their troubles. What I've learned from asking historians of immigration is that at every point in our history, we felt threatened by whatever was the new group. Germans in the 1840s, Irish after that, Italians, Poles, you name it. There's always been a threatening group that always seemed different from the ones before, that had always worked out. But we've been able to absorb them. And as those of you overseas, if you see somebody who is an aspiring scientist or entrepreneur in India or Pakistan or China or, you know, you name 20 other countries, they recognize they may be able to have a better chance here. And if we can be the arena for their ambitions, that is a huge plus that the U.S. has. Anybody who really disagrees, I'll be happy to answer later on. But I think that's one strategic advantage nobody else for the foreseeable future can match. A second strength the U.S. has, which we may underappreciate. You in Alaska might appreciate it better, and also some Texans, but many of Americans don't, is the institutional resilience and culture of resilience America has often had. I'll give you the sort of highbrow and the lowbrow version of this point. The highbrow version is all through American history, if you read our literature and our political rhetoric, the tone has always been, we're about to fall apart. You know, that we've been right on the brink of complete collapse roughly since 1630. You know, it's true. The first sermon in this vein on American soil was in 1630. And they're saying, you know, you had been so great back in 1620, but now things, you know, kids today are terrible. And this is how it's always been. We've had terrible problems. For example, the Civil War. And we've had other problems, you know, almost as bad as that. But part of our animus, part of our animating spirit has been the idea that we're challenged by falling short of our ideals, by external examples we need to rise to, et cetera, et cetera. So the highbrow version is America has always had this consciousness of being threatened if it doesn't do its best, and therefore it propels itself to do its best. The lowbrow version of the same theme is the story of many of you and your families who have come here, my family and going out to Southern California when I was raised, of immigrant families, of people who recover from hard knocks and do something else. They move across the country. They find some other job. They just rebound. They have new family units. This is something that's not true of all other societies. It has been true of China. Chinese people are extremely resilient. But it is something that is a trait of Americans that we should make use of. We have also, going down our list of strengths, we have the advantages of scale. Alaska is a very important contributor to American scale in the resources, in size, and all the rest. But we have the continental base of the American market, of American language, and all the rest is a plus. We have advantages of universities. I will assert to you, I argue in my book, that American universities should remain the best in the world unless we deliberately destroy them. You know, they have a chance of being up there for a quite long time. We have our technology research base. And overall, I think that anyone sanely looking at the United States and comparing to anybody else would say, I'll place my money with the Americans. They have their problems. They have all the things we don't like about them. But still, this is a system with tremendous potential. What could be the fly in this ointment? What would be on the other side of the ledger? Surprisingly, at least I was surprised when I finally came, when I convinced myself of this, I think the only real problem with America is something we place our greatest pride in, which is our system of government. by which I mean this. Everything that's strong in America is strong because it's constantly changed. Your university is in the middle of repositioning itself. All universities are different from what they were 50 years ago. Corporations have entire new strategies. They rise and fall. Technologies are different. The only thing that can't really change is our rules for governance, the way the Senate works, the way we have appointments, the sort of the rules that were set for a society of about 10 million people 225 years ago are being applied to a society of 330 million people with entirely different technologies, and I think there is real strain here. And in my own home state of California, you see a test case of this, where it's a state that in its private ingenuity and wealth is richer than most nations, and yet its public institutions are paralyzed. This last election may have done something more, but its public institutions are paralyzed even while it is so rich. That's in a way a model for what might happen. Why I pay attention, and I hope the next administration will, to the mechanics of government, how people vote, how the Senate passes bills with or without filibusters, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to bring this U.S. section to a close and move on to the big finish. If you looked at America, you would say it's a phenomenal entity that's been put together, and its only problem is contingencies that the founders 225 years ago, before electricity, before steam engines, before the continental expansion, couldn't possibly have foreseen. And will it be possible for them to adapt? Now, what happens if we match these two narratives? China, such a success, but with some problems. America, its own kind of success, but with a sea anchor placed on it by its rules for governance. I think I have an also mainly positive news message here in the following ways. First, I think it is almost miraculous in historical terms. There could be so large a shift in international power, China going from poverty to this great powerhouse in one generation with as few direct conflicts of interest with the existing power as there have been. Certainly, there are conflicts, but this is not like England and Germany 100 years ago. It's not like Japan in the 1930s. It's not like a lot of the other very difficult and tight situations that have evolved. Part of the reason is that the United States and China are far apart from each other. Now, China is surrounded by countries with which it has tense relations. The United States is not one of them. It's far away, although the Navy is nearby. It also is the case that on both sides of this equation, Chinese and American, you can argue there's actually been successful diplomacy for 30 years now. On the Chinese side, they have constantly decided it's in their interest basically to be friends with the Americans rather than poking a stick in us whenever they can. On the American side, from the presidencies of Richard Nixon in the 1960s to Barack Obama in the 2010s, the policy that's been most constant of all international policies is our relationship to China. And through that whole time, our policy has been we'd rather work with them than view them as an enemy, as we did the Soviet Union. We'd rather hope that they grow rather than they collapse or stagnate. And number three, we are still going to disagree with them on a lot of issues, political, strategic, and all the rest. That's been the policy. It's the policy today. I think it reflects well on both sides. The relationship has been managed as well as it has been. There are many areas of tension that I can address in questions, the South China Sea, currency manipulation, and on down a long list. I think, again, it's impressive they've been managed as well as they have been. And one other part of this, which will be the segue to my conclusion, is worth noticing. Almost Deb and I observed many, many times how easy it seemed to be for Americans and Chinese people, speaking in generalities, to get along. That's not been my experience, at least my personal experience, all around the world. There are places I haven't really gotten along. And we lived in Japan for a while and sent our kids to Japanese public school. And being able to penetrate Japanese society is difficult. Being able to penetrate Chinese society, in our experience, is easy, especially for Americans. And it is impressive across the great extent of China to see these strands of relationship. The people in some village who have a cousin at Michigan State, or the place in another village with a school built by missionaries, American missionaries, 100 years ago, or the young Americans running stores in Shanghai or in Qinghai or wherever you want, and just the many, many layers of connection. Again, in my book, China Airborne, I talk about the ways in which people from Alaska and elsewhere have gone into China and made themselves part of the fabric of society in the interest of safety and environmental protection and all the rest. I think this actually matters. It sounds like blather. It sounds as if, oh yeah, person-to-person relations. I think it really matters. I think probably the best thing that China could do for its soft power is to let more people in there more easily, because Americans who go there like it. And even if they have disagreements about, even if they hate the pollution and they hate the traffic and all the rest, they basically like the people. And they find this an easy bond. And that, I think, does matter in the long run more than I used to think it meant. So what does this mean, final short part, for the country, for universities, for businesses, and for young people? I think it mainly means to engage in all ways. That's why I'm glad the Confucius Institute is teaching Chinese here. I'm glad many of you have traveled there and will. When there are some Americans who don't like the idea of learning Chinese or learning any other language because they think, oh, this is just so we can truckle to our new paymasters. This is the language of the master, etc. I don't think that at all. Apart from everything Deb has said, and that I agree with my tin ear for languages. She has a great ear for languages. I don't. One reason why we stick together in China is that languages are just interesting in life. But also, I think that if young Americans and young people from other countries can become comfortable with a China that's going to play a larger role in the world's experience, that is a very important and good thing. They don't have to live in China. They don't have to pay a lot of attention to China. But recognizing it as a comfortable and natural and not threatening part of the scenery, I think, really is a tremendous step forward in their own prospects and also in the chances for these two countries to work together on lots of issues as they should. So I've talked for a very long time, and I want to have time for questions. I'll just leave you with this. I am, as a journalist, I am by nature skeptical, cranky, looking for faults, making trouble, saying, oh, this or that might go wrong. So that's what I do for a living. As a person and as an American, I'm generally fairly upbeat. When I can find areas of Chinese-U.S. relations that can feed the journalistic dark side of my personality, of thinking, boy, it's going to be really hard for China to evolve politically, or it's going to be really difficult to do anything about climate issues in time. But my basic sense of optimism that I have as an American, as somebody from California, is increased every time I go back to China and just feel the energy that is there, and that it is basically positive energy as opposed to negative and threatening energy. So to have a supply of positive energy with people who think they can do new things and do many of them with us, or at least not against us, that is a welcome thing on the world scene and something that I wanted to share my impression about. So with that, I'm going to rejoin my wife, and she will tell me what I got wrong, and will be happy to answer any questions that you may have, which I think the students will monitor.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with National Correspondent for The Atlantic and National Book Award winner James Fallows. His talk, entitled Postcards from Tomorrow Square, was recorded in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on November 12th. If you would like to listen to his wife, Deborah Fallow's talk, recorded earlier in the day at the UAA bookstore, about learning the Chinese language, you can find a link to the podcast at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.